Value add isn't paint and countertops anymore. In today's market, it's plumbing, power panels, water loss, and knowing when to walk away from a deal that looks great on paper, but will destroy cash flow. Now, today's guest sees things very differently. Mark Schuler is a licensed architect and multifamily operator who's been on both sides of the table, designing buildings, owning them, and fixing the mistakes that most investors don't catch until it's too late. He's been involved in thousands of apartment units serving more than 12,000 residents, and he specializes in deep value add workforce housing where operations, design, and capital discipline all collide. In this episode, we're going to be digging into the following. What heavy value add really means in 2026, and which upgrades actually move NOI? How rising rates, tenant volatility, and regulatory pressure are forcing operators to completely reevaluate assumptions? And then why strong operators, not market luck, are now the difference between surviving and losing a deal? Mark, welcome to the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. It's great to have you here, my friend. So what does value add mean to you today? Compare it to what it meant, you know, 3 years ago, you know, back in 2022, 2023, when you know, we're at an all-time low interest rate environment and rising tide was lifting all boats back then, right? It's a very different business model then than what it is today, to a certain degree. In fact, I would love to get your perspective there. And what does that mean today, compared to what it looked like back then?
The definition of value add, I mean, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different operators. It can be as like lipstick on a pig, to, you know, the deep value adds that we do, which is all new flooring, all new paint, all new trim. We do granite countertops in every unit. We rehab all the cabinetry. We do tiled tub surrounds. We fix, you know, leaky bath valves, and, you know, we put glass vessel sinks in every bedroom, or every bathroom, pardon me. You know, we're really trying to create a premium brand at the C-class level, which is kind of where our buy box has been for several years. And now, you know, we're buying or we're renovating all the exteriors. So I did a color scheme for 175 of our buildings. And so we're now fixing all the rot and repainting all the buildings. Brought a buddy of mine who's a talented landscape architect here in Seattle. All he's done for 30 years are multifamily communities, and we're redoing every campus. You know, we're redoing, you know, hardscapes and pools and, you know, amenities and playgrounds and courts and entries and wayfinding and lighting and all that stuff. You know, a lot of the assets that we own were C-class deals, and they were of a vintage. No question about that. But assets designed back in that era, they weren't these amenity-laden assets that you see now, the A-class stuff coming online. Baristas and workout rooms and sport courts and, you know, concierge service and all this stuff. I mean, they're definitely lifestyle amenities that the older product just didn't have. So we're now trying to actually retrofit these assets to have, you know, at least some of those and, you know, improve the lives of our tenants as a consequence.
How do you define the ROI on some of those added amenities, you know, and comparing, you know, this Class C vintage product to this new Class A stuff that's got, again, all the bells and whistles, you know, half of which probably still doesn't get used, but it's great for marketing purposes and to attract the tenant base in. While they have the intent of using it, they typically do not. You want to add value to the resident base that's there, but you still, there's some underlying reasonings for doing the amenities as well, which is, you know, hopefully you drive your, you know, your return on investment, right? Drive your NOI. And so how do you find the balance there?
When I figure it out, I'll let you know. we have a lot of internal dialogue about that very point. Is like, are we over-investing in this property? Are we going to get ROI on this investment? Then we flip it on its head. Is it, you know, look, if we don't do it, are we going to be able to maintain our tenant base? Because, you know, there are people moving in with certain expectations for, you know, they're, you know, something of a lifestyle experience, and they don't want to just be living in an asset where it's just raw dirt everywhere. So it's, you know, it literally is property by property. And that's why we had to bring in my buddy, because we're not experts in that. And he has a real refined eye, and he was able to like pinpoint some, you know, cost-effective upgrades that we can make to these properties that would improve the experience, but not cost a fortune.
Let me take this approach, and this could pertain to an amenity or just an upgrade in units, right? Like different type of product that you're using to upgrade units. Is there one upgrade that maybe in the beginning you underestimated until you saw an actual, you know, the actual NOI impact that it had. It was much greater than that, what you originally anticipated. Is there anything that comes to mind?
I just really think cleaning up the units. I mean, these are C-class deals, and so they are pretty worn down. And our thesis has always been, let's push it, you know, to, you know, C, C minus to a B minus B. We have seen over a decade now, our tenants are willing to pay the bump on the rent to have a dignified place for their head to hit the pillow at the night and every night, you know, but that you can't just like throw paint at the wall and think that's good enough. I mean, I've talked to so many operators where they think they can spend $5,000 to maybe $7,500 bucks and they call that value add. I call that a turn, you know, that's right. Like the base minimum that you're supposed to be doing. That's not value add. So, you know, you have to really make these upgrades meaningful, and the product has to compete with best in class. And we do. So, you know, I mean, we've got designer lighting and crown. I mean, who puts crown molding in a C-class deal, you know, and then does a two-tone color scheme? We do, you know, and we have the results to tell, you know, and we've monitored that for a lot of years, and it does pay dividends for us. You know, and look, you have to understand that all of our labor is on W-2 with us. So we really control the expense side of our ledger. You can't shop this stuff out. You get crushed on the cost. You know, for us to turn a unit costs us $18,000 to turn a unit. That is $35,000 to $40,000 for anybody else. That's just the steep discount we get on our supplies and labor.
No, I think your approach is unique in that, again, just coming from, you know, through the lens of an architect. So I would love to, you know, when you're looking at a new prospective opportunity, maybe share an example. I love kind of your case studies. You know, maybe an example of where there was a physical or a structural detail that caused you to walk away that maybe 95% of the other prospective buyers would have missed because they're not looking at it through the lens of a trained architect, right? They're, you know, numbers might look great, performer looks great, location looks great, neighbor looks great, but there's some structural details, physical details that you've identified that you're like, that's just going to cause more headaches than it's worth. Is there anything that comes to mind?
The classic one is looking for the fire starter electrical panels. You know, you just kind of survey the entire property. How many of them got to get replaced? That's, you know, for us, like 900, 800, 900 bucks a pop. And, you know, you're already behind the eight ball on your rental budget if you go over a certain number of those, percentage of the property has to have them replaced. One that nobody thinks about, and I think about all the time, is a lot of these units were pre-piped for washers and dryers in the unit. Over years, those lines get clogged and lint backed up in an exhaust pipe like that is the number one reason, one of the top reasons why buildings go up in flames. So, you know, are we going to have to go through and unclog all of these lines? There's a brush you can put on a cordless power driver and push it through there and clean that out. But, you know, that now I'm going to have a labor crew on my property for a week trying to hog out all these lines. That's one thing. The plumbing. I mean, if you buy an asset of a certain vintage, you may have a lot of galvanized pipe there, and there's just no salvaging. Now you're looking at an entire repipe of the property. That's a deal breaker for me. I can't repipe a property. So that's one.
Is that because is the, you know, the repiping, is it, I mean, obviously a cost factor, right? But just the intrusive nature of doing it, right? Oh, I mean, yeah. Like you're pulling back drywall and
oh yeah. Yeah, you're opening up all sorts of walls for the entire property. And
yeah,
now you got to do sheetrock repair and prime and paint it and, you know, retrim maybe. It's a big expense. Now you're into heavy duty construction.
I guess using an example like that, and I don't want to, because you've got a couple more to share, but I just want to make sure we don't miss this one. So like the galvanized pipe one, obviously there's a lot of properties in the U.S. that still have galvanized pipes. Maybe use an example of a property that came for sale. You went through it. You liked everything else about it, but then you determined that, gosh, I mean, this deal killer, like galvanized pipes, like I'm not even going to mess with this, brain damage, way too much, too expensive, too intrusive, too timely, like just, you know, too much brain damage. Let's move on. There's someone else that bought that property. Inevitably, someone else bought that property. Do you think it's a function of them just missing that major component, or it's maybe a, hey, like I can get in, I can put the lipstick on this thing and I can get out. And more than likely in the next 2 to 3 years, I'm not going to have too much of brain damage from that galvanized pipe. It's not going to cause me too many worries. And so you pass it on to the next person in line and we make my money and I move on. What's the mindset?
I'm not sure I can climb into somebody else's mindset when they buy an asset like that, but it certainly seems that's the case. I mean, certainly prior to, you know, the current situation in the industry, a lot of people were trying to ride that, you know, the rising tide raises all ships, you know, theory. And look, a lot of people got in the business who had never been an operator and really didn't know anything about operations. And so they were buying deals that never worked. And they didn't work for just a huge variety of reasons, not the physical defects, but, you know, operationally as well. If I can reframe this, you know, one of the first things we do when we walk on a property, you know, one of your biggest expense line items is water and sewer, by far. That is one of the biggest expense line items in any budget. And so when we first walk a property, we're looking around and trying to figure out where the leaks are. And after we take one down, we'll send a crew out there and they'll spend a week looking for the leaks and we will plug those leaks. That water and sewer charge can really move the needle on your IRR and your NOI. But if you don't even know to look for it, you're going to have mobile home parks are notorious for this, you know, because they're generally older. Like in the state of Washington, you just can't build a new mobile home park. So the ones that are here are from like the 50s and 60s. And they're all buried pipe and it's all leaking. And, you know, so you got to run around and try to dig up that pipe and replace it. You know, same can be said for vintage properties. But you got to know to look for it. So it's better to be proactive around this than reactive. You know, plan ahead for it. So, I mean, certainly that's one of the big ones. You know, water heaters. Water heaters, they're only designed to go 6 or 7 years and then they puke out. And especially where we own our deals, the salinity of the water is really high. And so the coils in these water heaters just fry. And so, you know, you just got to go in there and assess when you're doing your due diligence, how many water heaters are we going to replace on this property right out of the chute? You know, am I going to have to replace 100, 150 water heaters right away? What's the cost involved in that? You know, because a burst water heater on second floor, that's a tragedy right there. That's a big deal. I can't answer the question about how other operators look at it. I know how we look at it. And we're just like, you develop a lot of scars. If I pulled my shirt off, you'd see nothing but scars. And, we now have this pretty fleshed out checklist of things that we're looking for as soon as we step on a property.
Geographically, I know you're based in the Pacific Northwest, but I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys also do deals in Texas. Is that correct?
I do deals exclusively in Texas.
That's it. Okay.
I don't do deals in the Pacific Northwest anymore.
Interesting. Okay. Well, great. Well, maybe that leads me to the next question. I was going to ask you, just managing the regulatory environment, in a state or in a region that isn't necessarily all that landlord friendly. I was going to ask how you mitigate that risk and how you, you know, run an efficient operation with some of those variables. I know that you're not buying there anymore, but it sounds like you might still own and operate there.
I own one deal here yet.
Maybe speak to some of the challenges. And I think there's a lot of folks that probably have made moves just like you that, you know, maybe invested where they live and it happened to be in a not so regulatory friendly environment. And they, you know, chose to invest outside of their backyard because of that reason, you know, hence buying in Houston, buying in Dallas, buying anywhere else where it's more of a landlord friendly state and more protective of business owners. And so I guess just during the time that you did invest in the Pacific Northwest, just how did you manage those regulatory issues?
Changed dramatically during my tenure investing here. I own three deals here. And the city of Seattle enacted a lot of, depends where you sit, what side of the coin. It's either tenant friendly or landlord antagonistic legislation. The net of it all is it made it impossible for me to operate here. I can't evict people 9 months of the year, just eviction moratorium, 9 months of the year in Seattle. And Seattle can bloviate all they want, but that is the regulatory reality. I cannot do criminal background checks on my tenants, which means I can have a level 3 sex offender set up next to a family of 4. And there's not a damn thing I can do about it. They enacted in the time I bought, between the time I bought my first deal and my last deal, 38 pieces of legislation that just made it very, very, very difficult to operate a business here, a multifamily asset. So I just, you just see the writing on the wall and it's just time to move on. And so decided to move to, look for deals in an area that ticked a lot of boxes for me. You know, I'm from Detroit, and so I know a thing or two about workforce, housing. I've been a housing architect my entire career. And, growth story of Houston is it's fantastic. You know, it's right in the middle, the anchor of the Texas Triangle. You know, it's just, a job creation engine there. There are a lot of people looking for a lot of housing. They're not building enough housing to keep up with the demand. So there's all this upward pressure on rents. I wouldn't say that Houston is anti-tenant, but the playing field for doing business there is a lot more level. You know, yeah. What a concept.
Fair, right?
It's a lot fairer. So for the privilege of living in one of my rented units, you get to pay your rent. What a concept, And if you don't, I will evict you. And so there's enforcement and there's teeth to compliance down there that just does not exist in Seattle.
Yeah, we should probably change the nomenclature. It's either not landlord friendly or landlord fair, not landlord friendly, right? Because I feel like most rents, landlord fair, I think is
that's all
better
I'm
terminology.
Looking for is a fair shake. I mean, a lot of people think, I'm making all these bazillions of dollars and I'm lying on the beach in Hawaii drinking Mai Tais. This is not the case. The margins in this business are really thin. It is an extremely difficult business, especially now. It's a big boy game, and you got to want to do this because the insanity of it will drive you mad. So to have then government like accuse me of whatever it is they think I'm doing, they think there's in Seattle and Western Washington, there's literally this mentality that there is a cabal out there of landlords who are setting rents in the marketplace, and there's a monopoly going on in rents. That's just not the case. So how do you, at a certain point you stop, the reason went out the door long ago. So you just stop operating here and you find a place where it's more landlord fair. I like that term.
It doesn't sound like you have bought too much in 2025. You see as 2026, it sounds like you see some opportunity here. There's quite a bit of debt that's maturing starting this year. Anything specific that you're doing to position your company to take advantage of some of these opportunities that you might see coming in the next couple of months and years?
Yeah, we are really tightening our operations. I mean, we are doing a lot of work around that. We probably have another 4 to 6 months of work around that. We are dealing with a lot of macroeconomic forces and trying to figure out strategies around that. You know, the bond rates, I don't want to get too political, but, whenever there's a temper tantrum out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, stock market drops 800 points like it did today, and bond rates go up 15, 20 basis points like they did today. So, so you got to monitor that and just kind of figure out, okay, what is my business plan going forward? And we're taking a wait and see. I don't know if we're going to buy anything before the fall election, because I don't know if it's going to continue this way down this path. And like, you could try to do a refi or try to take down a deal. And, if it's going to take you 45 days to take it down, interest rates could like totally skyball all over the place. And within those 45 days, it could go up, go down, go back up. It's just, the unpredictability of it makes it really difficult to do business. And there's one thing this industry hates is unpredictability.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, it kind of ties into this conversation. It's just, what are you doing today differently to stress test, your assumptions, rent growth, time to stabilize, all those factors with, again, some of the uncertainties that you just expressed there.
Cost of insurance went up. Cost, taxes went up. Cost of labor has gone up. So your operating margins have, instead of assuming that you're going to be operating in maybe a 48 to 50%, you now need to be operating at like 60% of cost. You know, so, you know, you just lost 10% in free cash flow right there. So now you've got to like, that has a direct impact on the basis that you buy at. You've got to manage your labor pool a lot more effectively. I can't tell you that, again, not trying to be political, but I can't tell you the number of times ICE has rolled up on my properties, kicked in doors, you know, and terrorizing my tenant base. And so all of a sudden, occupancy is not a challenge.
Is that predominantly in Houston or is that in your Seattle property?
You know, I've got to like constantly be releasing these units. Well, before I release them, now I got to make them over. And now the velocity of the makeover is faster than I budgeted for. So how do I, you know, what do I do there? You know, instead of leasing a unit one time a year, I'm leasing it three times a year.
So you've seen that much of a detrimental impact with these ICE raids, you know, specific to your properties. You've seen quite a bit of turnover as a result.
September and October of last year, I lost 15% of my tenant base.
Wow. I haven't had this conversation before. And so I haven't had this conversation with someone that's had a that's been directly impacted, you know, property owner that's been directly impacted by it. I'm sure there's hundreds or thousands of them out there, but so I appreciate you, your vulnerability and willing to, you know, share this information.
This is the unpredictability I'm talking about. It is really challenging to operate a business right now. So we're working hard now to really, you know, they work hard, you know, they're not gang members or anything like that. They're just, you know, hardworking family people coming home at night and trying to put food on the table. That's all it is. But they are so terrorized. You know, we go to their units and the keys are sitting on the counter. They're gone. So now I'm having I had properties drop down to 70, 75% occupancy and actually 85%. One of them dropped down to 85% and we had to like do a full court press. And over the course of a month, we were able to kind of release all those units and get them back up, got us back up to the mid 90s on that particular deal.
Well, I think that also be able to lease up that fast. I mean, that speaks to location's everything, right? So if you've got a great asset and a great location, then there's always going to be demand. It's unfortunate that you have events that would cause that high of a turnover in such a short period of time, but also knowing that you've got, you know, such a great location that you can, there will be a line of folks that you can attract to move in and, you know, step into your unit, put that roof over their head is, it's a big benefit.
It's not just if I can put a plug in there for myself, it's not just the location of our asset. It's the operations that we work really hard and are continuing to burnish that end of our business where, you know, instead of, I mean, we use several pieces of software to help us with this, but, you know, instead of touching, you know, and look, leasing units is all about touch points. And so if you touch people twice, it's not enough. You know, now we're up to 6, 7, 8 touch points over the course of a week, trying to get people, let them know that we really want them to come on in and rent a unit from us. That has, you know, real ROI, that kind of exercise. So we're investing heavily in software packages and now AI to help us with this, where a lot of those calls are automated. And there's a human voice on our end talking to potential tenant. Tenants having a conversation, only they don't know it's AI. AI has gotten very sophisticated and can talk in a variety of languages and do that work for us. And that takes the labor component off the table for us. I mean, I get a consistent product, meaning those phone calls, they're 100% consistent every time. They go out and we're saying the same message, exactly the same every single time. And it's on a set schedule. And that has radically increased our success rate with leasing units. So it's just a matter of finding these tools that help us operate at a much higher level than we have been previously. And we're still fleshing that out, Canada.
So I know that we've been talking about multifamily this whole time, but you've got another exciting adventure that we briefly discussed before we started recording here today, which is real estate adjacent is how you put it, which I really like that terminology. Maybe share some tidbits of what other projects you have working on.
A friend of mine brought me a business opportunity a couple of years ago and asked me to underwrite the business opportunity. So I kind of sat down for a week or two in front of my Excel spreadsheet, trying to build out a profit and loss statement and then a waterfall, see kind of what the cash flow and the returns looked like. And it was like eye popping. But more importantly, it didn't involve all the operational headaches that I have with multifamily. So the business opportunity is, it's an entertainment play. It's indoor golf simulators, which is kind of a fad right now, but it's something that's going to be around for a long, long time. We're building a series of simulator locations in the West Phoenix Valley. And we kind of have cornered the market down there. So we have four open at this point. We're launching our fifth one right now, and I'm in the middle of raising capital for the sixth one. The returns are far better on the golf thing with a lot less risk that I face with the multifamily. And, you know, for the first time in a long time, I'm having fun. It's just a lot of fun to kind of be doing this. And, you know, our locations are very she, very clubby. We put them in these kind of bougie malls. And, you know, we're doing a high-end fit and finish on a beer budget. And people love it. People love the experience. It's membership-based. We do a lot of parties and corporate events. We're catering to spring training down there now. We're qualified with Medicare for silver sneakers. So the idea is to build a lot of cash flow, profit centers and it's a cash flow model, you know, unlike real estate, which is more of equity based. This is a cash flow based model, which is what I was looking for.
I think you had referenced that you guys are, you're a master franchisee, but this is a franchise. So just generally speaking, you know, what's it cost to get one of these units up and running and build out? And, you know, open for business.
You know, it depends on how many bays you build out, first of all. So, like, I think we were talking.
I think you said the standard is five, right? Is what you guys are doing?
Yeah, we do five bays. And the cost of the tech alone is like $60,000 per simulator. So there's, you know, $300,000 right there. It's about $140,000 for the TI. You've got...
the size of the location, what?
4,500 to 5,000 square feet. And they're leased spaces. So we signed 10-year leases with 2 5-year extensions. Yeah. You know, all in, each location is about $600,000. And, you know, just as I was outlining the cost, you burn through $600,000 just right away. Got some, you know, marketing costs up front. You got to get that ball rolling. You got to have some reserves, pay, you know, rent when you're starting out.
Like your first location you opened up, how long did it take you to get to a break-even point from the day you opened the doors to?
I think, you know, it took 6 months. We're just getting there, but it's been up and down. So, you know, we were really up in like September, October. We did really well those 2 months, did okay in November. And then like December just kind of fell off the map. But I was just talking to my partner yesterday or the day before, and all of a sudden we're crushing it. So we're still trying to figure out that location. The funny thing about that location is the zip code, the parking lot of this mall we're in, literally the zip code changes from one half of the parking lot to the other. So on the social media and the Google Maps and all that, people get confused about where they're going. And it took us 5 months to figure that out. You know, how the hell do you, you know, you don't know that going in. And so we made that adjustment in late December, and it seems like it's paying dividends now. So, you know, just kind of keep plugging along. A lot of the other three locations, we had pre-sold 50 memberships per location. So doing pretty good.
What's the projections, you know, as far as like a stabilized unit? Like what type of gross revenue does one of these stabilized units bring in, or do you anticipate that it will bring in? And I know that's a loaded question based on market to market and neighborhood to neighborhood, but just, yeah.
My underwriting holds. We're going to be grossing over $1 million per location. And we're running about 46% on our expense ratio.
So in a perfect world, you know, even after, you know, some lease up time frames, I mean, a worst case scenario that you would hope to maybe be made whole, get all your money back out of the deal in 3 years, I would think would probably be a...
3 to 4 years. You're exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and we're doing an investor... kind of thing. We've toyed with SBA loans, but, you know, with, talking about unpredictability, you know, the government shut down. And so the SBA is backlogged 6 months. So we're having to take on investor money and, you know, we're pretty generous. We're doing a 75-25 split and we're trying to get investors their money back in under 4 years. 100% return of capital and then, you know, 75-25 on excess cash flow. You know, and candidly, we're already talking to venture capitalists who want to buy us out. Looking at a big multiple.
Sorry, and guys, for those that are curious, it's called the Back Nine is the name of the concept. So you can Google it. Mark and I were chatting and I'm a member of a golf simulator up the road from me. It is not this brand, but there is one of these brands, the Back Nine, about 10 minutes away from where I live. So
people always think this is a fad. Well, you know, Top Golf was there for a New York minute and Callaway bought them for like 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago for $2 billion. 6 weeks ago, they sold it for 1.1. They took a $900 million haircut. And it's because this kind of experience exists at a far lower price point. I can develop one of these things for $600,000. Your average Top Golf is like $50 million. And there's no contest.
If you could leave our listeners, let's get back to multifamily here. If you could leave our listeners with maybe one lesson, one piece of advice, you know, as it relates to multifamily deals, and we'll keep it, you know, to today, 2026, 2027, you know, just any helpful advice that you would leave them with, what would that be?
Just understand that the industry is going through a reset right now. Interest rates went up, cap rates follow interest rates, and values run in the opposite direction. So when interest rates went up, cap rates followed suit, which tanked valuations nationwide. So multifamily is worth 30% less now than it was 3 years ago. That's just the reality of it. Unless you have really strong operators running that property, there are a lot of people losing their deals right now. And so their opportunity exists in 2026 and probably into 27 to pick, you know, up deals at a really good price point that we haven't seen in 10 years. And so that's what we're looking for. But going forward, you can't play the game of the rising tide raising all ships. Don't do that. You have to be a strong operator. You really have to have your operations all locked and loaded and ready to kind of manage this deal effectively and profitably, and especially if you're taking on investors. So, that's my best piece of advice right now.
Alrighty, fantastic. Well, that's awesome, Mark. Appreciate you coming on here and, just again, sharing all the meaningful insights and wisdom that you have. I guess for those that are tuning in that want to learn a little bit more about you and your company, where's the best place to find you?
I've got a couple of email addresses. You can send it to mark@schulerarchitecture.com. There's no C in Schuler, S-H-U-L-E-R. Or you can send it to mark@sgreinvestmentsplural.com. I am in front of this box all day long working and generally respond in about 3 minutes.
Yeah, to everyone listening, if you enjoyed the episode today, please do take a moment, subscribe to the show, leave a rating review. It helps us, you know, continue bringing on great guests like Mark to the show and helps us keep the podcast growing. So until we meet again next week, I'm wishing each and every one of you guys strong deals and even stronger cash flow. Take care now.